Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. It once again I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know what you've done.
Good evening and welcome, everyone. This is Stop Child Abuse Now, SCAN radio show number 3019. And SCAN is a production of NASCA, the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. NASCA is a nonprofit 501c3, and I'm going to read the mission statement of NASCA. We have a single purpose at NASCA: to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so with only two goals. One, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, CSA. Presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. And two, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse, and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. Okay, and tonight our survivor professional co-host is going to be Bill Murray from Los Angeles, our founder, the founder of NASCA. Bill's recovery is 12-step based and spans over 3.5 decades. Sexually abused by numerous clerics, all men, between the ages of 11 and midway through high school, a minor seminary, he was also the victim of prepubescent pornography and even a 2-week kidnapping. Bill was graced to have found Alcoholics Anonymous when he was 30 years old. The program not only helped him get clean and sober, but also gave him the place to give up his secrets and the tools by which he's recovered. He firmly believes one can use the 12-step process to heal from child abuse trauma and to find a way to a comfortable life. On these episodes, we welcome various co-hosts, survivor professionals, survivor professionals who will field questions, topics posed to us by our callers. Everyone's invited to engage on tonight's show. If you'd like to be on our panel and ask questions of Bill or make comments on, you know, what he has to say, please call in. We really, really love it when you call in, so it's great. The phone number is 646-595-2121. 646-596-1618. I'll repeat that. 646-595-2118. Please call in. And I would like to introduce my co-host, Victoria. Victoria, would you like to say hi?
Sure. Hello. Glad to be on tonight. This is my first night, so I'll co-hosting. I've been, of course, on the radio show, but yeah, I'm looking forward to coming on Thursday nights with you or whoever's on Thursday nights. So,
well, that's
thanks.
Wonderful.
And,
welcome.
I've heard Bill's story, but it's nice to hear it again because you always hear some more wonderful stuff for Bill.
Right. Okay, yeah. And Bill, you're here as well. Would you like to say hello?
I am here. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. I'm the, as you say, the founder of NASCA. So I've been on quite a few times, and Victoria is telling me that she's heard my my story. Well, that's good because I'm not going to tell my story tonight. That's not the purpose of the night that are Q&A discussion shows. You might hear parts of my story, certainly, as if they come up in relationship to an answer to a question or to an explanation of something, because that's my experience. But generally speaking, we hope that this question and answer discussion with someone who's a survivor and a professional can become more popular again. It was popular at one time, and we'd like people to call in and just, you know, it's an easy to do show because you can bring something up. You can say, I'm just listening for now. You can ask a question. You can ask the co-host to explain things, and so forth. So that's the idea of the show. And it's not, strictly speaking, me telling my story. Me telling my story happens a lot because it's my, my website, I guess. It's my nonprofit, or I started a nonprofit. So with that, and many times we encourage the co-host to bring a topic because that makes it go all the smoother when people don't have to fumble around thinking about, oh, God, what am I going to ask him, So I've done that, and it's up to Annie whether she wants to go in that direction or if she'd like to do something different. But I'm happy to do either way. And you guys, of course, are going to present questions to me too, of course. What would you like to start with?
Okay. I do not have a topic. I was going to text you and say, hey, do you have a topic? But I didn't do it. I'm sorry. So I don't have a topic.
I have something,
Victoria?
I'd like. Yeah, I have something I'd like to talk about. Because when I first met Bill, I wasn't talking about my child abuse because I didn't escape at 21, and I had a whole bunch of shame about it. I wasn't telling anybody. Even a psychiatrist said, well, you must have enjoyed it or you wouldn't have stayed so long, you wouldn't have kept coming back. And that was before I was getting admitted. When I was suicidal, I almost said bye, but something kept me in that seat, and I got in and didn't get a lot of help because I wouldn't share it a whole lot until I met Bill. And he talked about grooming, and I was wondering if Bill could explain that because a lot of people don't understand that. And I don't know, people think when you magically turn 18, you have all this power and knowledge and insight and expertise or whatever, that you can make, you can get yourself safe, And I just didn't understand this whole grooming thing. And I wasn't just abused by one abuser, more than one. And plus it happened before I even remember that stuff had started happening. And I couldn't figure it out. But just through being part of NASCA and learning more about, the dynamics of abuse and stuff. So that's what I'd like to ask Bill to talk about, because I think our listeners could use that information as well.
That's a great topic. And by the way, it's not just going to be a one topic evening. We may cover, four or five topics. I don't know. Depend on how long you guys want to continue. And when it feels like we've said enough about the first topic, we'll go to something else and so forth until we have the 90 minutes. But that's a great idea to describe that. I was definitely groom. So what is grooming? Grooming is the preparation of a child by a predator to engage in the abuse that's coming. Also, when the abuse is going on, you get predators that continue to kind of hold the carrot out and take advantage of children, because children can't, you know, like as you say, Victoria, they can't disseminate, they can't figure out what's right and what's wrong, and we're very confused the first time we're abused usually. But anyway, mine was a case of, now a lot of times it's, you know, I'm going to give you a privilege, or I'm going to let you sit in the front seat of the car, you know, or and this can be with relatives too, by the way. In my case, it was photography. I was very interested in creative arts or whatever, and I didn't have any introduction to any of that, unfortunately. But the fellow that ended up being my first major molester, predator, was a photographer, and he's quite a good photographer. He had a dark room and very nice, heavy Nikon cameras and so forth. And the era we're talking about is the 60s, in the mid to late 60s. He actually was also the counselor for the pool, which I was in and out of the pool all the time. I was a fish, you know. And so the pool was where he met me. And he came over to me when I was taking a shower one day after swimming and get the chlorine off and so forth. And he reached over my shoulders and down into my bathing suit. And he grabbed my testicles. He said, "What nice little rocks you have," or something like that. He used the word rocks. I remember that. And I was shocked, you know. So, you know, there are different responses that children have when the first time something like this happens. And one of them is to freeze, and that's the one I took. Flee, freeze, or flight, right? No, wait. What did I say? My choice was to freeze. I turned into a statue, you know. And eventually he further seduced me, if you want. It's like a seduction, into coming over to his darkroom. I already knew he was the photographer for the place. And the place I'm talking about was a summer camp. I was going to be there for a month, but I was going to repeat that two more years. So 3 years in a row, a month at a time. And his photography was fabulous. But when he opened the door to the darkroom, man, it was like, you know, going into Disneyland, because there was so much stuff there and it was glistening. And I didn't know what he was going to do, but he ended up molesting me sexually in the dark room over and over and over. That was one of the principal places he did. And the attraction here was he introduced me to the cameras and to his how he ran his photography. He rolled his own film. So I learned all kinds of things, how to print negatives and so forth. And he let me, you know, use the cameras to some degree. And these are big, heavy professional cameras with long lenses and so forth. And I was fascinated by that. So that was how he continued to groom me, because I knew whenever we got together, he was going to, you know, let me use his dark room or his cameras. But he was also going to be with me. He didn't let me have it alone. So that's an idea. That's a suggestion of grooming, and it continued in my case for quite some time. Well, at least that first year and first month. We have somebody there. Okay. All right. We need to know who the 619 area code person is, don't we?
Hi, it's Regular Girl Bill. I'm listening.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, we're gonna just continue with talking about Well, a variety of topics, I hope, but right now it's about grooming, which Victoria asked me about. So that was what he held out, you know, over my head or in front of my nose. And I was not being violently abused. I didn't even know what sex was, but I knew I was feeling good when he was doing what he was doing to me. He never asked me to do anything to him, so you know, I just had to like lay there pretty much or sit there or whatever. Then I started to become a model for him. Basically, he took thousands of pictures of new little Bill over the 3 years. He certainly did. And he showed me them. And, you know, later, I didn't think about it then. But later, here's what happens. The thing you're groomed with and you think is fantastic turns around on you. Because I didn't think about it, but he could have shared them with anybody. I didn't know that. You know, I didn't know there was a community of predators who were perhaps pornographers as well and child pornographers and so forth. But that's what I found. So that was another way to entice me, because he took, as I say, he took fabulous pictures, and I wanted to be noticed, you know, in some way. I wanted to be, you know, special. So he kind of made me a model for the month at a time. And he may have had other boys too, but I didn't have to do anything with anybody else. So that's what happened with me. I'm happy to say that it took a long time, but you know, eventually I was able to get away from him. And then when I went to the seminary, which is mentioned in the bio that was just read, there were priests and brothers there who were interested in me too. So I was sexually abused by them too, all men. And all this happened between the ages of 11 and about halfway through high school in the minor seminary. So it spanned about a 6-year period or something. So I'll pause and see if there's any questions you'd like, or if anybody would like to add something to what I was just explaining. This is not all on Bill's thing. Everybody gets to participate in this, okay? So grooming is the topic, and I don't want to take too much time before allowing somebody else to step in and give us their impression. Who'd like to go?
Thank you, Bill. Thanks, Bill. It's Annie.
Right.
And I was going to talk about what my father was, my molester, and what he did in terms of grooming, but I'm kind of confused about it. I remember in a family of six, he would take me alone to things, and we would do stuff together alone without all the other brothers and sisters. And I was kid number four, you know, I was just a middle kid, so I'm not really sure why I got selected out like that. But I did, and I'm wondering, is that grooming?
Yes.
Because he abused me way before that, when I was little. So grooming can be even after? I mean, and
I
like on an ongoing basis?
Yeah, I do. And this thing that he did was the grooming is giving you a privilege that the other siblings didn't get. And I guess one that you enjoyed. So that's as simple as it can be. It doesn't have to be something you know, painful. It doesn't have to be something threatening. There's people who predator, you know, sort of came onto them in a vicious way and said, you know, if you tell anybody or so forth, I'll kill your pet or your mother or whatever. There was none of that in this. And there usually isn't in grooming, because grooming is before, at least it begins the process of the predator. And it has to be something that brings the kid back, you know. Now, in our cases, we were stuck there. You were the child of the parent, and I was in this summer camp. And, I mean, I was going to say, you know, my summer camp was filled with boys, only boys. There was another camp down the lake, that, or down the river, that was for girls, and my sister went there the year later. But in your case, you know, maybe he, I don't know, how many girls were there? Maybe he just, you know, found you attractive because you were a girl. And, you know, predators can see
well, there
either
was,
one.
There were three of us. Yeah. Uh-huh. There were three girls. And I think that, I don't know, I could be wrong. Maybe he took the other ones as well, you know, singly out on trips. I never asked him. I will have to bring that up in a sister conversation. Maybe I wasn't the only one that got taken out alone.
Right. But once you, once you didn't fight him, you know, even if you were mad or something like that, but you didn't fight him and didn't seem like you were going to tell anybody, it was much easier the second and third and fourth time to to entice you into going along. And that's also part of it. You know, they have to pick, actually what they do is they, generally speaking, pick the weakest link or weakest person in a group because that's who they, you know, can get over on. And you know, it sometimes is the youngest person at the time, but then they grow a little older, and then the father might, you know, latch on to the next younger person as they come along. You know, sometimes they get tired of our age because of our age. That's part of what happened
with
me.
Yes, I think that did happen. I think that did happen to me, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That happened to me for sure at about 16, 17, or something like that. I had a growth spurt, and when I came back to school for junior year, I was not the little kid anymore. I was, you know, sort of a gangly teenager now. and I was angry then, and they knew it, because I, you know, I would clench my fists, and I would, you know, I'd run the other way, and I did all those things another time, but not the original one. The original one, I froze. And, you know, if you're a kid and somebody does something to you and you don't know what it is, you you might freeze, or you might run, or you might fight. But generally speaking, you don't fight with an adult because the adult's way bigger than you. but that's it is common that that occurs, one of those three things the first time. Then after that, it'll change its shape because, the predator kind of gets to know what works on you for him or her, and that's the one he'll stay with. It's not unusual that a father has a preference for one child over another or one among a group, but it's quite often that if he's not attracted to the boys but he is to the girls, he'll kind of use the first girl, the oldest girl, until she's not as small as she used to be, and then he'll switch off to the next girl. And so I wouldn't be shocked to hear if you came back someday and reported that you talked to somebody and confirmed that. So
I'm going to talk to them.
It's a family disease, right?
Because
they have to be, frankly, they have to be somehow attached familiar to you. That's a word from family, right? And so in my case, it was a family disease, but this family was the priests and brothers who I was brought up with and among, and was taught to, you know, they could do no wrong, and I had to follow them and all that stuff. And so that's a familial thing, you know. And then, of course, yours is too. I know Victoria had some of that as well, and so did regular girl, frankly. She's here. You know, we have to be wary of, you know, anybody who's acting a little different, and especially if they seem to be preying on the weaker of the group, weaker kids. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, who's 207? I don't. Wait a minute. Yeah, I do. That's one of our hosts, right? Isn't it? 207. No, it's 206 is what I have. Hi, who's the 207 caller? What's your name, please?
Kathy.
Hi, Kathy. Thank you for joining us.
Good subject grooming. I listened. I was groomed as a child, a small child, and I think
sure.
one of the things with grooming that I feel is there is I didn't know it was wrong. I mean, I had by the time he had started to, you know, penetrate me and fondle me and have me fondle him, I had I thought it was, you know, that was just normal. He had already, you know, read stories to me. I remember the story he was reading, and the couple got in the back seat for an adventure of the car, you know, and I figured, well, who's driving? Where are they going? What's the adventure? And, of course, he goes to show me that they're not going anywhere. They're going to the back seat of the car. And, you know, but it for me, I was a little, it probably stopped when I was eight to nine. But I don't even remember when it began. I think it just began at the early when I was little. You know, he just would always tell me things, and I looked up to him, so I believed him, and you know, that was pretty much of it. But I remember when it stopped, and I think this is the issue with most abusers, and it's why they want to keep your secret in all kinds of other ways, or violent or threatening or other ways to continue, is to keep a hold on you, to control you. And he had figured, I guess, that, you know, by the time he was touching me, that I was already in the game, you know, it was already happening. It was like I was participant here, as if I had actually made this decision. So, yeah, grooming is a good topic. I wasn't able to hear anything Tuesday, and it was a story. I considered bringing that subject up, so I'm so glad you brought it up. It's such a prevalent thing. But anyway, I just want to say that he almost got caught because I came down from his room dressed improperly, and that couldn't have happened without my getting naked. And I covered for him.
Right.
And I know that he was, at that point, and for many years, I thought, oh, he's scared of getting caught, you know, and realizing, you know, I knew it was a sneaky little game, but I didn't think it was wrong. I knew it was a secret, but I didn't
right.
really think it was wrong. And I think right. that's one of the things with grooming is when you really think you're in on it. By the time, you know, you're in on this, this is our decision, you know, and of course, I was far too young to make such a decision.
As I said earlier, Kathy, that the first time I was approached, I was shocked. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't somebody I knew particularly, and I didn't know anything about sex or sexuality. My parents were really uptight, you know, Catholics, and that's how I was raised. So I guess they were waiting for the priests and the nuns to teach me whatever they were going to teach me, but I had never heard even heard the word sex. So that's how it first happened. But then later, when I found out that he was a photographer, then he was able to hold that out to me. But he had to take a risk, in other words, to approach me the first time, and he did. And he must have looked around and saw what boy was, you know, he, in his opinion, a little weaker or a little more reachable or something, because that's what they do. They go after the weak group, weak one. So that, you know, so your reaction to it can also change, you know, through the course of what's going on.
Yeah. I realized, though, that when he almost got caught and then he stopped, it wasn't because in hindsight and therapy and whatnot, going over it, it wasn't because he didn't stop because he was afraid of getting caught. He stopped because the game was no longer fun anymore because he had to depend on my not telling anyone in the family what was going on. And, of course, I didn't. I didn't for many years. But I just think grooming is almost where you actually get the kid in many ways to completely be complicit and agreeing and caring about this person who's taking you under his wing or her wing. Because women do it too. It's not always men.
No, it's not.
No, it isn't. Go ahead.
Let me tell you another one. Another instance of grooming was with one of the priests that I went to the minor seminary and he found me there. He was our Latin teacher, and he was among all of us because every kid had to take Latin. In fact, you had to take 2 years. And you could, you may take four if you were smart enough to get through the first two. I wasn't. But for the first 2 years, you know, I experienced him kind of looking at my homework or the work I was doing by him leaning over me from behind and putting his hand down. And he would, like, take my hand, and he would put it down in my lap, and he would feel my penis through my clothing, but he would feel it. Later, he started dating me. He would ask, and because I was a very lonely kid, he had times when he would take me out to dinner when all the other kids were at home. You could go home if you had good grades, and I didn't. But also, I was 800 miles from home, and everybody else was close by. But he would take me to a small restaurant, and that was like, he's like, he's dating me, you know, as a way of attracting me. I think I cut you off, Kathy. You were going to say one more thing.
No, I think it was the same. It's the same sentiment. You feel special. Suddenly, you're put in a position of being, hey, you're special. You're under my wing. You're one of
That's
mine.
Right.
You know that
right.
It's the same. It was the same sentiment. And for me, I wasn't 800 miles from home. I was home. You know, I was in my home, and there really wasn't any place to go. And of course, I was covering for him. I would cover for him because I didn't want, you know, because he had groomed me to be his, little toy. So that's what I had been for quite a little. It's hard to remember because, like I said, I didn't think it was wrong, so I wasn't holding it as this is an important thing. It wasn't until years later that I realized it was wrong, you know. And I think it's,
yeah.
I saw great, you were speaking earlier about fight, flight, or freeze, I think they call it. But it's really, you're right, the opposite way around. It's freeze, flight, and fight. I mean, first you freeze. I know later on I was violently raped as a teenager, and it was, the first thing was, I was just shocked. I mean, he came in my room and it's just, what the, you know? I wasn't expecting it. And then he pushed me down, and I tried to enforce himself on me, and I was trying to talk him out of it, actually, going, you know, come on, what's going on here? Why? And then, of course, I tried to fight, but first it was freeze. I didn't really flight. I was in the room, and they were in the room. It really wasn't. I guess I tried to talk him out of it. That's also not uncommon, you know. But, it didn't work. He's bigger and stronger by then, and there wasn't no grooming involved, you know. But it was the same perpetrator. And, it's just the way that it was. But I just think it's a good subject. And I appreciate your coming on the show tonight because I have listened on many nights, and I hear lots of stories, and they're all very compelling. But when you have
Kathy, I know who you are, and I just want to say that, you know, I wish you would call in more often yourself because you have a lot to offer. I'm no longer as involved with the shows as I used to be in terms of hosting because we have a nice group of people who can host. I still produce all the shows, and frankly, I'm there almost every night anyway in the background because,
The first time I listened, I called in because it's easier for me to hear on the telephone with
yes.
my techie. And I live in the booty. But anyway, and I was really surprised. You had a panel I'm going to speak. I was kind of floored. But I really, it's great. It's great to be able to have a space to be able to tell your story and let it out. And that's good. I always think that.
Yeah.
I always appreciate NASCA for that. But, yeah, grooming is, it's very different when you're really groomed, in my view, and I've spoken to others who've had the same, obviously, same situation or very similar. We didn't think it was wrong. And the kids, I didn't think it was wrong at all. And we did know about sex, you know. Dad was a cad, always talking about women, and mother would all catch him. And, you know, there was plenty of, I knew about it, but I didn't think it was wrong.
Right,
you know?
Right. All right, well, I got to include these other people, but thank you, Kathy. Stay around because we're going to – I'll come around to you again.
Okay, well,
I'm
going to hang up and listen, and I'll call in maybe if I have something to
we're going to cover other topics when we're finished with this one. So thanks
great.
A lot for being here.
Great, grooming's a good one, though. Thank you for bringing it up.
Sure. So Victoria or Regular Girl or Annie, would any of you like to – proceed with the next comment or next question?
Yeah, I can jump in
sure.
here.
Sure.
Well, I didn't know that my biological father, who I refer to as my sperm donor because it's the only good thing he ever did, started sexually abusing me the day I got home from the hospital after I was born. And I didn't
right.
find this out until I was an adult when he was abusing me, and said the day I came home from the hospital, I wanted to suck on his penis. Okay, so that
oh, yeah.
went on for a year until my mother sent us away because she said, you know, I knew you guys were in danger. Now, she didn't know what danger we were in, but she had that motherly instinct. And she was getting beat by him and stuff, you know, but she didn't know what he was doing. And but she sent us with my grandparents, so I had no contact with him. But what I do remember is when I was a little kid, my grandparents would go in bars every weekend. We just spent the whole week in the bar. And these guys would just grab me and put me on their laps. And, of course, I was wearing dresses all the time. And put their hands up my skirt or dress part and fondle me and kiss on me. And it didn't even occur to me to fight them. I'd look over my grandparents, and my grandma would just be looking, you know, like, no big deal. So then I can remember one time, I don't know how many times this had went on, I just told my grandma, I don't like when they do that. Why are they doing that? You know, I wish I wouldn't. And she says, oh, they just do it because you're cute.
Right.
Well, yay. You know, and so
right.
that just went on. And then my neighbor, he had strawberries in his yard. And he was had the kids come over there and pick strawberries, and then we'd play the game called Trouble, and then he would tell the other kids to go home and pick one of them, and mess with them, and he ended up raping a 3 and 4 year old girl, who of course you know told, and then it all went to court, and the cop went around to all the neighbor kids and was saying, did this man touch you? And I said. My grandma looked down at me, and half of her was worried, and the other half was scared. And, you know, she just had a confused look, and you could just see terror in her eyes. And she goes, tell the police officer if something happened. You know, I go, well, you know, he touched my pee-pee because, like, I didn't know the right words, you know. And so anyway, nothing was said or anything. And then all of a sudden one day they said, oh, tomorrow you're going to go see the judge. You've got to go talk to the judge. You got to tell him the truth. And the whole way up there, tell the truth, tell the truth. Well, I got in the judge's chambers. It was just him and I. And I told him what, you know, because he asked what he did, and I told him. And he says, well, I don't understand. Show me. And I tell you what, it felt just like the way it was, you know. And my godfather used to French kiss me and give me 50-cent pieces, you know. And I always felt really bad about it because I didn't like it, and I knew it was something he wanted. You know, I wanted that 50 cents. And,
well, that
and
was the grooming part of it. The other part is
yeah,
the grooming, but 50
yeah,
cents.
Yeah, and it wasn't just like one person. It was just like almost like there were different ones that kind of built me up to the point of when I was a teenager, I really believed that the only reason God put me on this earth was to sexually satisfy men because
right.
that was the message I got my whole life, you know.
Right.
So I just
yeah.
wanted to say that doesn't just have to be one person that, quote, grooming you. It's, you know, this repeated stuff can happen, too, where
yeah, no.
it just seems like something about me is making these guys do this to me, is, you
right.
know. And then I guess I just came to the conclusion is that was what I was put on this earth for.
Right. Well,
you know, and
it
kept happening.
It's an old idea that women are, you know, kind of property or that's how they're going to be used.
Yeah.
You know, but in this last century, we changed our mind about it, at least to some degree, hopefully. But
mm-hmm.
there's still people hanging around thinking that way. You know,
oh, yeah.
It is really bad. But, you know, it's not something.
But no protection either. Like, my grandma didn't, like, you know, talk to me anything about what she found out, you know,
right.
that neighbor yeah. guy, you know. And he even asked me, he says, you tell your mom, because everybody thought they were my mom and dad, because, you know, nobody knew they were my grandparents. They just act like they were my parents. Nobody questioned it. And anyway, you know, he said, do you tell your mom what's going on over here? And I said, yes. Well, my grandma had told me that, you know, if you tell a lie, you're going to hell. You know, be there for eternity. But you know what? When I told that lie, he stopped doing it. And so I was like, I guess I'll just go to hell for the rest of my life because he stopped, you know.
Right.
It's so freaking confusing if we don't tell kids what you know, to, we don't explain things, or they don't have the right words to describe it.
Right.
But, again, that judge even, you know, I mean, if, you know, I keep envisioning Mariska Hegarty, who plays the sergeant on Law & Order SVU, if, you know, I keep imagining her coming to my door and how my life would have been different if, you know, I had her as my advocate. You know, if a judge would have done that, she would have went after the judge, you know. But,
well,
yeah, I take it back. I wish, you know, I wish some things had been different, that, you know.
The Law & Order show is to some degree following, you know, current themes and so forth. But on the other hand, they don't really follow them. I mean, every show they resolve everything in 90 minutes or 60 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And actually that's like 44 minutes because you have to format
with
all the commercials.
Yeah.
So anyway, you know, but the grooming process can. For me, as long as it, you know, until he, for the first time, insisted that I go down on him, I was fine with it. I had never seen his penis. I had never had any thought of, you know, having to reciprocate what he was doing to me. And it took all 3 years for him to figure out a way to get me away from the camp itself and my parents. And it was in a car. Going to Montreal, I was shocked. He pulled my head down behind it, my hair behind my head down, and put it in his lap. He had his penis out, and we're driving down the street in New York City with the people all around us. And
God.
I was shocked.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was, and of course I was disgusted enough so that I refused to do anything to him anyway. And that was kind of the reason for him taking me along on this trip. At least he believed he could take advantage of me to that extent, and I just wouldn't let him. That pissed him off. But I'm just lucky that he wasn't a violent predator. And you can't tell that. It's just the way it might be, and it was with him. So,
mm-hmm.
But then it went on
to further victimization by other priests, right? I mean, used things against you as well.
That's right. But it was they weren't related to him. They were from another order.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I was saying about me is it wasn't just one person. It was like, okay, now somebody else comes after you, you know.
Right, right.
So I thought it was me, not about, you know. Of them being abusive.
Well, it's about us because it's easy to take advantage of a kid, and they know that. That's how it's about us.
Oh,
and,
we're vulnerable. Uh-huh.
We're vulnerable, completely vulnerable.
Yeah.
So, all right, regular girl or Annie, would you guys like to jump in with something?
I'll say something, Bill. Thanks. I've had my thing on mute because I have some background noise going on here, so I'll try and be quick as well. But listening really has made me realize how important this grooming thing is in my story and in maybe everybody's story, and also about how sex is just one part. It's not just about sex itself, although it is, of course, physically, but about how much control, the issue of control is involved in this whole dynamic. And one of my abuses had to do with a grand aunt who was molesting my brother, and about how the grooming part of it was so huge. And that part, that objection in me, like grooming was the incestuous relationship she had with him. She would buy him toys, and there was that kind of a special relationship. Like it was really kind of fairly common that she would take him out to dinner on a Thursday night. We lived in New York City, so there were not fast food restaurants, but she would take him to the diner or to a restaurant, and I would object to this. Why is he getting these toys? Why is he going out to dinner? That was like a special treat. We didn't go out to dinner except on birthdays and Christmas. And I noticed it and to say something about it, but just the fact that that grooming was such a big part of it, I'm really getting that by listening to you talk about it tonight. And about how much it's not just about the sex, about how control is such a big part of the dynamic. So I'm going to put it back on mute because I have background noise here. I can hear it.
All right. Well, let me make a comment on what you just said because I touched on it earlier, but it was really there's really more to it. But the 1-3-Set St. Vincent, the place at Minor Seminary that I went to, who used to take me out to dinner, he did it because he knew my parents were the type that did take the family out to dinner. I think we'd go out to dinner twice a month or something, or maybe more. And they were pretty nice restaurants. My mother wouldn't go to a McDonald's. Well, okay, that doesn't count as dinner. So we went to pretty nice restaurants. We went to the officers' club on military base and things like that, and regularly. And he knew that when I was at St. Vincent, I wasn't getting that kind of treatment. So it was easy for him to substitute for, my parents, that he would be the person that would take me to a restaurant and get away from life for a couple hours. Yeah, that's they learn who you are, and then they use that against you, of course, Annie, do you have something you'd like to add?
Well, yes, I have a thought, and I don't really know if I'm on the right track. But it seems to me that in experiences I've had dating, that dating can be grooming. Because, date after date, they try to soften you up, and then eventually they expect sex,
Yeah.
And I don't know, is that weird that I'm saying that?
No, I think it's completely common that when we're talking about boys and girls who are dating, that the object that the boy has is to somehow get in your pants. Sometimes that's the girl's object too, but most of the time it's the boy's object. And, we talk about first base, second base, third base, and so forth. They kind of score themselves. Ooh, I was able to cop a feel, and sometimes they'll repeat that to other boys. Now, I wasn't among the group that did that, but I understood it did. That did happen. So, it can be in the middle of a relationship where it can be, it can be sort of an ongoing thing in a relationship to kind of make you feel, buy you a present, get you flowers, take you to a football game because you like football or whatever, something special, and then expect each time to, be able to make a little more progress towards, betting you. That's very common.
I have friends, women friends in 12-step recovery from codependence, and we share with each other that there's this phenomena of attracting kind of maybe not so good people in our lives in relationships. So it's really good to have friends in recovery from this kind of thing because there's this tendency, like I have a tendency to attract men who are like my mother. My abusive mother. They come in the form of men. So it's kind of good to kind of check and have some good women friends in recovery is what I found.
Right. Right.
So, like that.
Mm-hmm. Well,
just pass
we all
on.
Need to talk. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ray. Sarah, go ahead.
I'm done.
Okay.
That's it.
I found it interesting that that when I first got in recovery, I didn't want anything to do with women. And it took me a long time to figure out why. My whole life, they were my competition. I wasn't used to having relationships with women, like just sit down and chat. I didn't have any girlfriends, it was competition. And I also believed that all men wanted was sex. So we'd go out to eat, and I'd just say, okay, well, let's come back to the place. Okay, And I really thought I had power in this whole situation. I also believe that it was my fault and I was attracting these people. In actuality, I was in a bad relationship or they might see me as vulnerable as we talked about before. And it's not that I'm attracting them. It's that they're picking me. They're the pressure.
Right.
They are really good at what they do, very good at what they do. And I was blaming and shaming myself, thinking that I was picking abusers when actually abusers were picking me. I had to say that. Sorry. Mm. I just had to jump in.
That's okay. That was all good comments. Let's acknowledge that all of us have had an opportunity to share a little bit and see if there's anybody who feels like they needed to do a little more, because I'd like to go to a second topic, offer that to the group, but I don't want to skip over anybody. So we had Annie, Victoria, and Regular Girl still here. Any further comments? I mean, I think it was a really good topic and a lot of good discussion on it. I appreciate it. All right, now how about another topic? Does anybody have a question they'd like to ask or something they'd like to hear discussed? Because I'm happy to you know, go anywhere with you three. No?
I can't think of one.
That's okay. That's all right.
I'd like to explain, Bill, how did you get okay, so all these things happened and it stopped. And so how do you start your healing journey? And you had said you, you know, some recovery, whatever. So how did that all start? So I know it was a little difficult for you to begin. And why was that for, you know, someone to be able to share that they were sexually abused but not get help? And
right.
No, part of it is you were a boy.
Yeah,
so I'll leave it there.
One of the fears that I had was that I would be called a fag or, you know, a homo or, you know, words that are pretty derogatory back then were used. And I didn't want to be called those things. I didn't want to be thought of as those things. So I kept my mouth shut. But later I, you know, when it stopped, I was completely embarrassed by what had happened to me and ashamed and didn't know how to get out of it. And it took all the way until I went into, you know, heavy drinking and using the drugs. It took about a dozen years, maybe, before I talked about it to the group. I talked about it to my parents before that, but it was a mistake. I was at my parents' home, and I had a lot of vodka one night, and I was talking to my mother about those damn priests. They were all gay. She said, "What?" And they weren't gay. They were male molesting, but that's what I thought. That's how much I thought. Anyway, I decided, oh, boy, that's, you know, now I got to deal with this. My parents are going to know. So we ended up going to a psychiatrist's office a week or two later. And it was like a place that nobody knew. And we didn't know him. He didn't know us. But it was a safe place because I wanted them to be in a safe place when I divulged this, especially my father. And I did. I talked about everything. The first session was just me, you know, like throwing up my story. And then the next session and the next session and the next session were used until pretty much all the questions my parents had been asked and all the comments had been made. So I actually did this around 26 or 27. And it didn't help. I mean, it didn't help me. At least I told my parents, and they knew, but they were not going to really engage with me. But at least it wasn't a secret between us anymore. And by the way, that secret is really powerful. So I was to go another 4 years or so and end up in California. And I was disgusted with myself to the point where I was willing to go to an AA meeting, wherever they were. I didn't know what they were. And, you know, I eventually didn't work right away, but didn't take too long either. I eventually surrendered enough to, you know, kind of dive into the program really head first. And that's when I told it to a group. I told my story to my sponsor, of course, but I would use AA by way of telling at least pieces of my story to various groups. Because after all, it's the reason I drank, for a big part of the reason I drank. You know, I was so upset and I needed to change my reality. I would drink till oblivion most of the time. So the people in AA in California, for the most part, allowed me to tell pieces of my story in anything I was sharing. And then eventually I was asked to start a meeting, and then eventually I was asked to you know, speak at a convention and so forth. So it's always been a part of my recovery that I include the child abuse and trauma. And that's how it happened for me. It's kind of an unusual way. But because it happened that way, you know, I devised a system. It was just a 12-step system. But in replacing the word alcohol with child abuse, I just used the same process. And I've been doing that for nearly 40 years now. And I'm clean and sober that long, too. So that's how it happened for me. But that's by no means the rule that it will happen that way, you know. So,
well,
I can tell
I've
how
heard
it happens for me.
Hold on.
I've heard how sponsors have asked their sponsees, what part did you play in it? Okay, we're talking about children here. What part did you play in it, and you need to make amends for what part you played in it? And I just, you know, of course, I got my own opinions on that. So what is your opinion, Bill?
I did not follow a sponsor who was sexually assaulted because there weren't any. I mean, I didn't know who they were. They probably were. I was the only one talking about it, you have to understand, in the whole of West Side of Los Angeles. And my sponsor had quite a story, but it had nothing to do with sexually, you know, being sexually abused. And I didn't hear that story very often. So I didn't have people to follow or ask questions of, but I did have the steps. And I simply applied them to the issue of being traumatized from child abuse in the same way that I did, you know, approach them from alcoholism. And that was my guide. So, and I didn't change anything. As you know, I still to this day use the 12 traditions to help guide this group. And they are
the organization.
So I and it's no, you know, it's a really perfect way to do it. I mean, I think it is. So, you know, I'm happy to say it all worked. Both things, you know.
Yeah.
But I just tell people that
you know, if you think that I have to make amends, I was a child and this happened to me, you know, or I was a victim of domestic abuse or whatever. I did not play a part in it. I was being abused. You know, I did not have to make amends to my abuser.
I
hear people tell victims of abuse they got to make amends for their part. You know,
right.
Whatever they did when they were a kid to make that person, you know, attracted to them or whatever. You know, and it just floors me that people are telling me that their sponsors told them they had to make amends.
Well, I didn't make amends for any actions that I was taking while I was being abused. I did make amends to the place, St. Vincent, that, you know, years later, when the abuse was way over and I was now in recovery, I made it to the institution. And I made it to a prefect that was not a part of the problem with me and somebody I admired and appreciated, you know, as being a good guy. I went to St. Vincent's and I told my story to him, and he was shocked. And you know, he wasn't shocked that it occurred. He was shocked that it was only 2 years after I entered recovery that I was doing this. And the reason I was making amends was not for any of the things that happened during the abuse, but after the abuse, especially you know, in my drunkenness and so forth, and in college, the statements that I made about St. Vincent's and all priests and the whole of religion and so forth, these things were wrong. And I felt that I had to make amends. I didn't have to, but I desired to make amends for some of my, that those were my actions, you know, and I felt they were insincere. They were not well thought out. And so I actually made amends to him, through him, to the institution, because I was blaming St. Vincent's all the time and the Catholic Church all the time and all priests all the time, you know. So that's what I made amends for. I didn't make amends for it because I was a participant in the abuse. I was the wounded one, you know. No.
Exactly.
I would never tell that to somebody. But I would ask them to look at what I just told you about. There may be things that, you know, amends are wonderful, by the way. They lighten yourself. They lighten your soul. And if you just use your inventory, and then after you've expressed the inventory, and that I did do with my sponsor, there were plenty of things on my inventory that could become the basis for the amends list that I eventually came up with. This was only 2 years into it, Victoria. So that's why the priest that I went to was so impressed. He was shocked, but he was impressed shocked. And he had been a priest for a long time. He was a doctor of psychology and theology, and they all were. They were around us. And he really appreciated what I did. He said, I don't usually stay up on a Sunday afternoon. I get to rest. That's the one time I get to rest after Sunday masses and so forth. But I was waiting for my nephew. He said, this boy has been giving his parents a terrible time. He's been in and out of drunk tanks and all kinds of, he's been in car crashes and so forth. And they've tried to help him. And I said, well, I don't know what I could do, but if you want to have him come over, I'll be happy to talk to him. He thought it was him. The father thought it was his nephew that buzzed the doorbell. And that's why he came down. But he said, but now that I've heard what you've told me and my nephew's due to be here any time, he said, I'd prefer that you would be willing to be the one that talked to him about recovery. What a privilege. Yeah. So you never know how these things are going to happen, I don't know if it had an effect on his nephew. I don't know. But I left in my big book, the one that I'd started with, and it was 2 years old, and it had circles and arrows and things written in the margins and underlined. It's, yellow markered. And I gave it to him.
Yeah, here's the direction,
So. All right, we still have nearly half an hour. Want to go to a different topic or continue on this?
Bill, this is Annie.
Hi, Annie.
This is Annie. Hi.
Yeah.
I was going to respond to the question of, how did you get started recovering? And I wanted to say that it wasn't until I retired that I even began. And the first therapist I went to, first time I ever went, he told me to go to a 12-step program. And it was a 12-step program where they had redone the steps for survivors of incest specifically. And that's the program that helped me for years and years and years. I was involved in that. I'm not so much anymore, mostly because I feel like my life isn't all about recovery anymore. It used to be, but now there's other things in it. And so I'm not as involved in recovery. And I think that's a good thing. I think that's healing. That's all.
Well,
thank you.
And the 12 steps are really powerful, and they've been borrowed by all kinds of groups and simply modified to whatever extent was necessary, replacing the word alcohol and alcoholism with their issue. So we have 50 maybe or more 12-step programs that are not AA but are designed to follow the AA sort of traditions. And, there's all kinds of stuff. And incest is one of them.
I was also surprised that I went to Gamblers Anonymous, and assuming that it was the 12 steps, which it's not. So I went back to my AA meeting and, as they say, practice these principles in all our affairs. Well, gambling was my issue. So I, you said, just replaced it. But GA didn't help me because it wasn't 12-step based, and that was the format I was used to because that made sense to me. At first it didn't. I was like, they were talking another language. Same thing when I went to, I started out in Al-Anon, I was in the mental hospital, and they said, well, you just need to make some boundaries with these people. And I said, boundaries? What the hell's a boundary? And I had no clue.
We had one of the oldest female members of Alcoholics Anonymous in the groups that I was going to. Her name was Alabama, and she told us that she too had a desire. She knew she had a problem with alcohol, but they wouldn't let her in the room because she was female. And they, and so she was bringing her husband and maybe a friend of his, something like that, to the room, and then had to sit there till the meeting was over. But she was out in the hallway, and she knew she needed it. She was listening, you know. And she's the one that got sober. So Alabama didn't even have to be in the room, but had to hear the message and then apply it to her own life. And then pretty much she was the one that convinced them that, yeah, I guess women could take advantage of this too. So let's open the doors and let them in. But I thought that was a cute story. Yeah.
It is. I'll say something. Because I guess the question was in the beginning. So I just keep thinking this, you know, the solution, and it says this in the big book, is spiritual. Because I had met people also, I had met people who said they didn't need the book, they didn't need the meeting, which goes back to what it says in the book, is that the solution, and this is true for me if I think about it, what was the beginning, the solution was spiritual. But I found I couldn't talk about it. I really was a chicken. I was a chicken shit about it. As much as lots of things were talked about in the meetings and with other people, I could not talk about that until I heard somebody else talk about it. And it was not talked about, that thing in particular. I don't think I heard anybody else start to talk about it until the 80s. You know, then I started, but really it was in film. I saw the movie Nuts. And, you know, what Nuts was about was not what happened with me, but I remember this. It's real weird. I was thinking about this. That abuse happened in the bathtub with her father. So I was not abused like that, but it was like this. I was trying to put together how did that event fit in with mine, which was seeing my brother be abused by this grand aunt, right? It was like I was trying to put together. So in reality, my story was these fragments of memories started to come back. And I think for a long time, I was waiting, because dramatic as I am, I've been waiting like for somebody else's story to get to come to me, you know, instead of my own, which is that little fragments started to come back. That's what started to happen, little memory fragments. And I didn't know what to do with them. So that's all I'll say for now about it. But the solution was spiritual. It always has been.
Right.
Well, and people have different opinions about that, but, you know, that played an issue in it too, I think, as well. Because in the 12-step programs, and this is a new realization that I have, that becomes like the big things. Who's most popular? Who's the popular sponsor at the time? That's what's followed, or the big book. These days.
It depends on where you are, okay? Because regular girl, I sobered up in California, but I was only getting sober. I was about 4 months sober or something like that, and I had to return to New York. And I didn't have a choice. I had to return to face a court date. So I flew back, and everybody was telling me, oh, you can't travel now. You're not sober enough. And I was like, well, I did. And I managed to get through the whole trip without drinking. But the point I'm making is I was shocked at how different the meetings were in New York City than the ones in California. Really shocked. And this is true no matter where you go. There will be AA, but it won't necessarily be the brand exactly that you're familiar with. And so the comfort level of how you approach meetings in a different place has to do also with surrender. You know, you can't ask the whole group to give up and do it, you know, your way. So you have to find a way to be okay within the midst. And that's what I did. So I came back to California, and I was still sober and blah, 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 you know.
I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying. I think that there's truth in that. You know, a ruler is a ruler. You know, we all know what a ruler is, right? And that comes from
a
view of scripture like that. A ruler, you know, a ruler. A
the
ruler.
Kind you make a line with? Or the kind that governs the body?
Yes. Yes, and that was my point. That was my point. You know, we need a ruler. We need something to measure things by that we all humanity agree with. You know,
well, the same 12 steps.
Instead of somebody else's popular opinion.
Well, it's more like the sociality of the group, the fellowship, right? In Los Angeles, I came to figure out that a lot of people are here because of the films and so forth. They want to make it big. Maybe they're an actress or something like that. Lots and lots of them in the rooms. and so they would be dramatic when they shared, and they'd always get applause. Applause is a huge thing in Los Angeles because everybody's in the show business and everybody wants applause. In New York, they wouldn't think of applauding, you know? And that was really a shock to me because somebody would bare their heart or tell a story that was really, you know, edgy, and then he or she would stop, and everybody would just be quiet. They'd call on somebody else. So, again,
yeah.
it's the mood of the style of the community. And I've been now to meetings all over the place, and I tend to recognize that.
So I'm making a commentary on this is maybe a time for all members everywhere to remember to lean on the anonymity of that tradition. Lean on it. Anonymity is the deal here. Principles before personalities. There's a reason for that.
Yep.
A reason why that's in there, you know. We should lean on that perhaps a little more.
Mm-hmm.
Is what I'm saying.
Well, that's a good point. All right. We have about 18 and a half minutes left. 18 minutes left. Let me turn Victoria's mic on. There she is.
Victoria, you're back on. Yeah, I go to Alano Club, and they have like 20 AA meetings and a whole bunch of Alano meetings. And every single meeting you go to is set up a little bit differently. So what I tell people, if you don't like a meeting, go to a different one. You know,
right?
Go to a different club. Not every meeting is going to be the same. You need to find out which one you feel comfortable in. You know,
right?
Because don't take AA as a whole out of one meeting. That's what I tell people. I said it
right.
Say that.
So Alano clubs is how we pronounce it here. Alano clubs are groups of alcoholics who, outside of AA, they may have met each other in AA. But outside of AA, they find a building that they're going to host, that they're going to rent together, and then they turn around and they offer it to AA meetings. So that's how you have the separation of service. So you're really contributing to the cost of the meeting, but the meeting is independent of the Alano Club and vice versa. The Alano Club's not responsible for the meeting either. They just provide the space, so... Yeah, I like the Alano clubs, you know. Let's see. Annie, got anything?
I do. I was thinking about why I no longer do meetings like I used to for so many years, and it occurred to me that one of the reasons is I don't want to be anonymous anymore. I want to say my name. Annie Margis, and yes, I am a victim, and I do talk about incest openly. I don't want to be anonymous anymore, and I think that's a place that people can grow into, where you accept what happened to you, and you go on.
It depends on the style of group you're in, and in California here, it's much more relaxed, kind of. There are many people who use their first and last name. It's usually people who are sober a while. But it was common in the home group that I came into, that I was lucky enough to come into, frankly, that they used both names, so I did. You know, and I didn't think anything about it, except because I was kind of protected by the sense that the group, everybody was doing it, or many people were doing it, so I'm going to do it too. But I agree with you. You know, it's a matter of, stepping out and saying, yeah, my name is Bill, but it's Bill Murray, and I live, in Los Angeles. You know where I live. You know my last name, blah, blah, blah. And I agreed with that, but I had to get, a couple of steps under my belt, but not a lot, before I started doing it, too.
Mm-hmm.
I understand what you're saying, though, and I agree with your reasoning.
But I think there's a place for anonymity in those meetings. I think it's very helpful in the beginning of my healing to know that I was in secret at the meeting.
Right. Right. Well, we recognize anonymity, the spirit of anonymity here at NASCA, too. And there are some people, regular girls, one of them, frankly, who can use a screen name instead of a real name, or can use, like, you know, Bill M. if they want. They can. We will allow them to change the place they are coming from. Like, they might have been in Riverside County, but now we could put them in Nevada. And that's only right next door, and no one would know who they were. We will change things like that are non-consequential in order to protect a person's anonymity, and that's how we cover it. We do, of course, want people to tell their name, but there are many people who are, you know, scared to death. I don't want anybody to find out. Okay, well, here's how we do it. You know, and we'll support you in there.
I understand. It's a big philosophical question. It is. I understand. Like, should their secret organizations be allowed? You know,
right. Right.
Esoterically, you know, there's gestational periods, you know, even in biological, the study of biological life, there's gestational periods where, you know, embryos or seeds need to be protected, you know, and under the dark and, you know, in the earth. So, you know, it's a big philosophical question. I understand that. I vacillate myself sometimes on it. I do, philosophically. So I get it, but... I don't know. I like that, you know, anonymity is a spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever binding us to place principles before personalities. There is the thing of it being an organization. You know, the traditions are to the whole of it, as, you know, yes, each group is autonomous, but then there is the entity as a whole as well. So there's that too, the care of it.
The steps are to the individual what the traditions are to the group. That's how I say it. But I understand what you're meaning completely, because I agree with it, that, you know, there has to be a protection for both, and that the traditions are the protection for the fellowship, the large group, as opposed to, you know, one of the principles that we follow for the individual.
And there's times I feel like I've shucked my responsibilities, quite honestly. I guess that's what's going on with me right now. That's what's going on.
Well, we weren't
going
to bring that up with you because we understand that you're still new and, you know, everything. No, I'm kidding.
All right.
It's good to have you around.
Wanted to say that Victoria Kelly isn't my real name. I changed my name because in 86 I started speaking out about my abuse, my domestic violence and being used in prostitution. And I picked Victoria because it means victorious. And Ruth was my middle name, which means spirit. Kelly means warrior. Well, I didn't feel like a victorious spirit warrior, but that was a goal I wanted to be. And today I believe that I am. I legally changed my name I don't use my real name. People don't know me by my real name because I don't have any people that I associated with, which I really didn't. I had no friends or nobody really in my life. And, you know, I just changed my name. And so I started speaking out. And the main reason was because I was speaking out in Minneapolis in the metro area. And my biological father lived out there, and I didn't want him to know that I was talking about it because I was still afraid of him because he had threatened he'd find me. And so for me, it was my protection. But then it was also my new identity, you know. And now, of course, that's my legal name. But, you know, I would go back to my sponsor kept calling me Kathy. That was my original name. And he'd go, oh, I'm sorry, you know, at the meeting, we'd be sitting playing cards, you know, she called me Kathy, and I go, oh, don't worry about it. Nobody knows. Because people are always calling people by the wrong names. You know, don't even worry. I know, but I should know. And I go, no, don't worry about it. She knew me for years with that name, Kathy.
I guess what I want people to hear is that NASCA is comfortable with any of these versions that we just talked about, and we'll change your name for your, you know, doing a show if you want. We'll help you do that. And, you know.
Oh, there you go.
We want you to tell your story rather than shy away from it because you're afraid somebody will know who you are. And if that's really a big deal to you, then we'll find a way to around that issue and still be able to present your story. So it comes to Kathy again, I think. All right, so we have just a couple of minutes left, and this has been a great show, I think.
Yeah.
It's just me.
I agree.
We have we have 9 minutes left. Kathy just came back. Do you have another comment? You've been listening, I guess.
Yeah. Hi, this is Kathy again. I just wanted to weigh in. Annie had said acceptance, and you go through healing, and you accept what had. And I think that that is a better understanding of what people keep talking about forgiveness, because that's not mine to give. And I'm hoping that I enjoy the show. Thank you very much. And also, one of these times, and I think I called in one time early on, and gratitude's important. I mean, even the
Absolutely.
Horrible things, you know, and I think that that would be a good topic for an upcoming show.
Well, you can present that. We won't do that tonight because it's too long of a topic, but you can present
these
things.
No, that's what I said, future. And I had thought about, you know, I appreciate that you, when you came on, and you first said, and your story's obviously very compelling, but and I'm not taking it away, but that you wanted to bring in topics, and I appreciate that, because sometimes I call in on Tuesday and Thursday, and that's really not happening. We're hearing from the story, from the co-host or the
I know, and it's not meant to be. What we did tonight is meant to be what we were supposed to do. I mean, that was
Excellent.
The thought behind it.
I appreciate that.
I love that. Kathy, I love that topic of gratitude. And I'll bring it up sometimes in a meeting and people are like, oh, not gratitude.
Well,
but I love gratitude. I love gratitude, yeah.
Tag me when you're going to do it, yeah. Kathy. I love you, dear. And thank you all very much for tonight.
Thank you. You know, you can come anytime and you can present a topic. That's the idea behind these shows. And everybody then gets to share on it, and multiple times. We only covered one basic topic tonight, but there are times when you can get two or three topics on and still be fairly thorough about what you have to say, what the group has to say about their ideas and their answers to, how does this happen? How does that happen? But that's the idea, and we're so glad I'm so glad that I was able to participate in tonight's meeting that way. All right? Let's see, how much time we have? 7 minutes. We have time for one more comment anybody wants to make.
If I could put a blurb in for my event, I'm having an event October 29th. It's
right.
For Domestic Violence Awareness and Awareness and Prevention Month. And the focus is on the effects domestic violence has on children. And
right.
I'm having an event out here in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and it'll also be on Zoom. We got 100 spots open, so sign up if you want. I'm on Facebook, and Bill knows how to get a hold of me. Most people in NASCA do. I'm on the NASCA website, and I would just really enjoy any support on information, if anybody has it, on either domestic violence, how it affects children, and also resources for information on nurturing children.
Mm-hmm. I'm excited about this for Victoria. I think it's a great thing to do. Of course, October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. It'll be at the end of October, the 29th, I think Victoria said. And it's going to be in Minneapolis. So if you can imagine making it there, you should try. Because, you know, I know it's a distance for some people, but for others it's not. And I'm excited about the material that you're bringing together, Victoria, and the people.
Thank you.
So good for
you. Well,
and
also, you participate on Zoom. You know, you can be there. And then you can also just be there in spirit supporting us, you know, just knowing that. NASCA and different individuals, you know, that contacted me said, you know, I got plans that day, but, you know, in spirit, I am sure with you, or I support what you're doing. So that makes it real important, too. You know, anybody can really throw money at things, but, you know, the emotional support and stuff for somebody that's trying to organize something, you can't even put a price on that.
No, you can't.
Add anything.
No. And I also like very much that, you know, for one, you know, for once, this event is really about the kids. It's not about what the adults do to each other. It's about the observation the kids make and how it impacts them as they grow up in a home or an area where there's domestic violence, and it's horrible the experience.
Yeah.
I really appreciate that.
I mean, even if they go to their aunts and uncles and, you know, once a summer for a week or something, you know, and there's domestic violence going on there. I mean, it affects kids, you know.
It affects
kids. And, you know, because with NASCAR, you know, people say domestic violence, they just think of the adults. I'm like, wait a minute. You know, I'm with NASCAR, and I've heard a lot of stories about domestic violence, and people just have a hard enough time identifying emotional abuse, you know, let alone what emotionally happens to a kid observing, like you said, domestic violence. And it's domestic violence awareness and prevention. And I always get into the point of how can we prevent this, and it's through education. And that's what we're trying to do.
Thank you, Victoria. And we'll have Victoria back maybe a week or so before the event, 10 days before the event, to remind us that it's going on. Because she has a plan to have 100 people there. I hope she does. All right, so.
Well, we got 100 openings on Zoom, and then we've got however many people show up. But, you know, I had one for child abuse, and there was about 5 people that showed up. But there was a bunch of people on Zoom. And then there was also one woman that looked at the clothesline project we had out there with survivors' messages on it. And she cried through the whole thing, and I tell you what, it was the beginning of her healing. And now I'm with her on her healing journey, and I tell you, you know, like AA, to me, I always say, one person at a time. You say the same thing in all my recovery programs. You know,
That's one person
at a time is, you know, if we can help one person, we've done a major thing.
Well, I want to thank Victoria, Regular Girl, Kathy, and, of course, Annie for this meeting. I think it was an excellent meeting. Annie, I'm going to throw it back to you to finish up the show. With your music and your announcements and so forth, but I do want to express my gratitude for you having me here today. So thank you very much. God bless you.
Thank you, Bill. And thank you to everyone who listened. And remember, the show is on 5 nights a week at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and you're always welcome to call in. And the number to call in, write this down, 646-595-2118. Give us a call tomorrow in the show and talk to whoever's on and ask questions and submit topics. It's a wonderful thing to do. And I don't have any other announcements. And so I will just say thank you, Victoria. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Regular Girl. And we'll be back on tomorrow night. And here's the song.
Another tomorrow, 'cause that dawn was-